14 inclusive. We jumped ahead on 16, the Day of Atonement, because the Day of Atonement is so closely related to the expression of the sacrifices and all that we have been discussing. But we come now to the special subject, clean and unclean food. Well, that's chapter 11, and it goes on with other uncleannesses through these four chapters. It is parallel to Deuteronomy 14, is it not? Deuteronomy 14, 1 to 21. Now, in Deuteronomy 14, 20, the last part of 21, it says, do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. That is not found in Leviticus. That is found in Exodus. And it has a problem all of its own. What that really means and why it was given, it is difficult to know. I'm not going to say a word about it. One view is that it is humane. It just doesn't seem right. Somewhat like this expression that you should not take, in a nest, you should not take both the mother and the eggs. Now that's a little bit different, because there, if you take, you'd say you can take the eggs, but not the eggs, the young and the mother both. Of course, in a sense, if you take them both, well, then that's the end of the family, you get no more eggs. So that may be a different provision than this. And this, whether this is just as humane, it shouldn't, doesn't seem right to take the mother and boil it. It's a peculiar thing. One view is that it was done because the pagan folks around did that, to avoid a pagan custom. That is possible, and indeed it's a very real possibility. On the other, there was said to be, such a custom witnessed to in Ugaritic material. In Ugaritic material, there is a passage that says that you should put a young goat on the fire and cook it in the milk. I don't think it specifies the milk of the mother. So that view was that here you have a Ugaritic prohibition, a Ugaritic sacrifice, and you should not do anything like that in Hebrew. That would be adequate, and it might be true. On the other hand, that passage in Ugaritic is from a damaged tablet, and whether or not it says this is the question. So we ought not to tie the argument too much to that tablet. It has been recently re-examined, the original tablet has been re-examined. I think it was in this biblical literature, this Journal of Biblical Literature, I think that's where I saw it, the article re-examined. And they claim that the letters that were thought to be there are not there, and it does not speak about cooking a kid in mother's milk. So I guess we're as much in the dark as we ever were about this particular provision. But still, I think probably the best idea is that this was done in a pagan context and it should not be done. Now, I mentioned that partly because that is one view of these laws of cleanliness as a whole. The Exodus passage occurs twice in Exodus, first chapter 23 and also chapter 34, does not give any reason for it, and in Exodus it is not in a context of cleanness and uncleanness. Deuteronomy it is. But there is nothing about it in the extensive subject of uncleanness in Leviticus. So whether it is the same as the other laws of cleanliness is debatable. And the fact is, we just don't know too much about it. And so when we say if we do it, they were to avoid it because the heathen did it, that's a good theory, but it is a theory depending on our ignorance of what the heathen might have done. So we're still ignorant. Short comment on that. To turn back to Leviticus, I think that Deuteronomy, in the parallel in chapter 14, doesn't add much of anything. It does not give the details. It refers only to the cleanness of foods and does not refer at all to the cleanness of sicknesses of any kind or to leprosy in the house, and leprosy in the garment, that sort of thing. It refers only to cleanness in food. And it says the same thing as it does in Leviticus. So it doesn't add much, except that it is, I think, held by a number that Deuteronomy is dependent on Leviticus. Offhand, it would seem easier to assume that Deuteronomy is dependent on Leviticus. It's short, says about the same thing, doesn't say anything about all the rest of the parts that go together with the uncleanness of the food. And so it'll be a natural conclusion, and I think it is adopted by many, which of course gives you a problem, because Deuteronomy, what was written at 620, and Leviticus was written at 450, and hard to, you know, need a prophet to work in there. Remember, the Deuteronomy is said by critics to have been written around 620 B.C., with some older material put in and some later material come in after and all that, but just the same, the kernel dates from around 620, and it is connected, they say, with the law of the centralization of the sanctuary. Well, that's very fine, but you know Leviticus also has the centralization of the sanctuary. So, which came first? Paul would think that it wasn't the law within Leviticus, and Deuteronomy continues the law, repeats the law, as it does other laws, as it does these laws of uncleanness. So I think that it is an interesting point, and probably correct, that Deuteronomy is dependent on Leviticus. Now I say dependent on Leviticus, I should say it's dependent on Moses who wrote Leviticus. If Moses wrote both, that would be, in short, the orthodox position is the logical position take on this matter of interdependence of these two. So we come back to Leviticus as the major place where the matter is discussed. And the question is, why were some things clean and some things unclean? And I suppose the auxiliary question would be, why don't we call things some unclean, and some unclean today? Well, the different views have been held. In my commentary on the subject, maybe I just quoted a phrase there. I can't remember all that I wrote. Quoting from the introduction, this is page 568 of my commentary on Leviticus. The Levitical laws of uncleanness have no known extensive parallel in the surrounding cultures. Now, that's pretty interesting. You are told, of course, that surrounding cultures had sacrifice, and so did the Israelites. You're told also that surrounding cultures had circumcision, and so did the Israelites. And you know the comparative religion school, what they do with this sort of thing. And here you have the idea of taboo. And, of course, all kinds of cultures have taboos. And these are taboos. And in those three things, we must oppose them. In the case of sacrifices, I have said and quoted in the commentary here that there were no sacrifices in ancient times that had the sprinkling of the blood, utilization, the manipulation of the blood, the way the Bible does. The biblical sacrifices to this extent are unique. Now, they did sacrifice. People have sacrificed, I guess, all over the world and, I guess, all over time. Maybe that's just a feeling that we should. Maybe it is an ancient descendant of the original truth from Adam to Noah. There are, you know, flood legends all over the world, too. And if the people remember the flood in some way, to some degree, they may have remembered sacrifices after the flood also. So sacrifices may have been, current sacrifices all over may have been, a reflex of some memory of ancient sacrifices after the flood. Now, that's almost impossible to prove. But I think we may say that there is an inherent feeling in mankind that we need something. We have a sinful heart. Now, people don't like to admit that, you know, but they have that feeling. Yeah, the feeling of need. Talk to a person, you know, well, of course he's not perfect. He knows he's not perfect. Yeah, he sure he knows he's not perfect. He doesn't want to admit he's a sinner before God. And yet, you talk to him, and there is that spark of in the nature that answers to his claim that he is a sinner. And when that spark is really fanned, and he understands that he is a sinner, then's when he's able, really seeking for a Savior. So the idea that man needs something before God is partly an innate idea of human consciousness. Now what will he do? Well, what they do is either a gift to God or a placating of demons. I think mostly the latter. You give an offering to the storm god. Hope you don't have a storm. You give an offering to some other god to make sure that they won't have an earthquake. And so the idea of placating the demons, is a very common idea in sacrifice. You don't have that in the Bible. What you do have in the Bible is a holy God, a sinful man, and a substitutionary atonement. So I say that the sacrifices that you have in the Bible are, although somewhat like some foreign sacrifices, yet they are distinct. And I will say also that the circumcision that you have in the Bible, although somewhat like ancient circumcisions, is nonetheless distinct. To make that point in the commentary here, I asked my teacher at Penn, Dr. Spicer, who was widely read and a new archaeologist of note, international note, and I asked him point blank if there was any such thing in antiquity as infant circumcision. And he said, as far as he knew, no. There is puberty circumcision. Among the Muslims today, there is puberty circumcision. In tribes in Africa, there is. And often associated with licentiousness. Coming of age and all that. Rites of passage. But infant circumcision, which can hardly be associated with licentiousness in any way, shape, or form, that is unique to ancient Israel. And I think that that's an interesting point. The sacrifices of Israel were unique sacrifices. The circumcision of Israel was unique circumcision. And this, though there may be some similarities with modern taboos, there is no, I think this statement stands, that there are no extensive parallels in ancient cultures. You don't find the law of Hammurabi with taboos. You don't find the other laws or the customs or the literature of the Egyptians with taboos like this at all. So there is an element here that it seems quite unique in the day and time of Moses. Well, what was it for? And the different views. I quote Feinberg, New Bible Dictionary. He lists the different views. That is, it was for spiritual reasons, for hygienic reasons, psychological, dualistic, and national, and taboo. These different types. I might read them again, though you can look them up.
What page is
that? It's on page 568. The spiritual reason. I don't know that I elaborate on that too much. I guess the spiritual would be that here God wanted his people to be clean, and these are cleanness of foods. Well, of course, God wants his people to be clean. But to transfer that spiritual cleanness of heart to certain types of food. Now, if you had all food and had to be washed, it might be a little different. But to select certain foods as clean, others unclean, the spiritual is not so transparent. But at least it is held. The hygienic will come too. The psychological, I guess, would be the idea that other people around, they ate, well, why don't you eat horse meat? You don't like the idea. I understood that in the army sometimes they had horse meat. I heard about a cook, First World War, I'm sure this was, not recent times. This cook tried to dress up the menu a little bit, you know. So he told them that he had rabbit pie. And the fellows tasted it, and they said, I thought it tasted more like horse. Wasn't there horse in there? Well, yes, some. How much? They said, it's 50-50. He says, one horse to one rabbit. Well, horse meat is edible. Why don't you find it in the shops? Why don't you find dog meat, cat meat? Well, you can find it some places and all, but there is, I guess, a psychological reason that you feel that this is good meat and the others are not good meat. I guess that's the psychological argument. It's not a very good argument because different people have different tastes. Some people like dog meat. And, well, I could tell you more stories, but they're not safe for time. The national reasons. Israel wanted to be separate from the nations. Separate in what ways? Well, separate haircut, separate necktie, separate food. You know, you can make national reasons why. The Indians had a certain haircut. The Indians had a certain haircut they called a scalp lock. And it was so as to be handy in case somebody cut off your scalp. Right on. Dualistic, I'm not quite sure that I remember what Feinberg means by dualistic. What would be the difference between that and, well, the dualistic can't say that it's spiritual versus physical because all foods are physical. I can't remember, and I didn't check in a New Bible Dictionary. You can look it up and see. I'm sure he would give it there. But I don't remember what the dualistic is. Rationalistic idea of taboo I've mentioned. But then the next sentence, the view of wholeness and abnormality as held by Wenham has already been mentioned in the introduction. I have to give a little detail to that because it's been spoken of a good bit lately. A lady in England, Mary Douglas, is an anthropologist and does not write as a Christian, writes as an anthropologist. And she has ideas of taboo and all. But she claims that the explanation of these Old Testament laws are part and parcel of the idea that what is whole and normal is clean, and what is abnormal would be wrong. Nobody does it, you know, therefore it must be wrong. It's not good for you. Must be wrong. And she argues extensively, I have discussed it in my introduction, that you find her views defended, to my surprise and chagrin, her views are defended in Wenham's commentary. He adopts that view. For instance, there are emissions in the body that are unclean. And she says that the body is conceived as a vessel, a pot, and if anything leaks out, the orifices of the body, but there are five, the ears, the eyes, the mouth, the genital organs, and so on. But if anything leaks out, why, that's unclean, that's wrong. Spit would be unclean. Well, maybe, although spit is not mentioned in the Old Testament, well, I think it is mentioned once. Tears would be unclean. Tears aren't mentioned, certainly. So her idea of wholeness and normality is worked out extensively by Wenham. For instance, you have fish that swim. Well, fish that swim, this is the normal thing. Oysters don't swim. Crabs don't swim. They're odd, peculiar, bad. Don't eat them. I don't know that fish are any more normal than eels. Fish have scales and eels don't. Cows move like this. Pigs move like this. Why should the motion of pigs be stranger than the motion of cows? It's not a bit stranger. So this idea is held and defended by Wenham, and I refer you to it if you'd like to look at it further. Of course, I discuss it some, especially in the introduction of my commentary, but I just am not convinced on that view. I think it's based on false anthropology, and it does not fit the cases that you have in the Old Testament. It is true, I suppose, that if you have a house that is gets green on one wall and has this funny looking stuff there, and you wash it off and it comes back, and it's peculiar and you don't understand it, it could be unclean. But suppose you have a house where the beams begin to sag, and that could be unclean too. Why a person would look at this and say, this is not normal, therefore it's clean, and some other problem, some leak in the roof, not normal either, but it's not unclean. So I have all kinds of questions with this view, but it is a view that is defended today. I'm not sure that others defend it largely. The view that I've gone over, of course, is the view that I suggest, that I support, and that is the hygienic view. The hygienic view. To my surprise, the hygienic view is given brief mention in the study Bible, the NIV study Bible. Does anybody have the NIV study Bible here? Yeah. Do you find it there where it talks about this?
Your comment?
No, it's view. It's not my comment. It is a comment that was given over my head. Read the comment and see if that's not what I'm thinking about.
On the subject 11 of verse 2, there's a comment that says, some hold that certain animal life was considered unclean for some.
That's right. Yes.
But it is just sort of substantive idea.
Yeah. Now, that's all they say. Here's a hygienic view. It's difficult to support this idea. Well, I wrote notes for Leviticus, you see, and the editors just wiped out my notes and put that in instead, just the opposite of what I suggested. It's an old view. As I say, it's as old as Maimonides, and it's as recent as Albright, and I think it can be, I think it's the only sensible approach to these laws of uncleanness. I think it can be defended in detail. And I try to do so. I'm interested also that that view is the view that is supported by Harrison, R.K. Harrison, in his commentary on Leviticus. Of course, his commentary, though it looks small, is twice as long as what I have here. Mine is just part of the book before you. But he gives, I think, about 46 pages on this uncleanness business. And I do agree with most of it. There are a few things where I would differ with him. But on the whole, the hygienic view, I think, is that makes most sense. This is what I would call public health. Public health. And I would approach it from that angle and would try to support it as we go down through the different instances of uncleanness given here. Now that's a general introduction. Any questions on that? Clear? That's my guess.
There's a question about the study Bible.
Yeah.
You're saying that the editor, maybe Ken Parker, changed?
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's right. I objected strenuously, and he said, it was not just Ken Barker, it was also Youngblood, Barker and Youngblood, and Speck, and one more, I think, with the editorial committee. And they suggested that in the next edition, I guess, after several million copies, they will put in the hygienic view is held by some. So, I wasn't very happy. There's several other things I'm not very happy with about the study Bible, by the way. In the passage, introduction to the book of Deuteronomy, it says that Deuteronomy was written by Moses except for verses 1 to 5 and the last chapter. Now, the last chapter I can understand, the death of Moses. But the idea that verses 1 to 5 are not by Moses in Deuteronomy, chapter 1, 1 to 5, first five verses of the book, that those are not by Moses. There's not the slightest witness that they're not by Moses. And I do know why they put it in, and I think it's a very false view. They put it in because it says in Deuteronomy, the first chapter, it says, these are the words of the Lord spoke to Moses on the other side of the Jordan. Now, if it was on the other side of the Jordan, why, it would be in what's now Palestine, and Moses never was in Palestine, you think? That's the reason. But it's a very fallacious reason. And the NIV does not translate it that way. The NIV translates it the east side of the Jordan. And the King James translated it, I think, on this side of the Jordan. Somebody has the King James? Check Deuteronomy 1.
Yeah, this side, Jordan in the wilderness.
Yes, I see. The word is Aver Hayarden. Aver Hayarden. Now, Aver means on the other side, right? You know it means on the other side. Well, look at the lexicon, it says on the other side. It comes from the root that means to cross over. We all know that. And so Aver would be the other side after you've crossed over. But if you look up the usage of Aver, Hayarden, you find that this usage, this phrase, is used sometimes in the same verse to refer to the Aver Hayarden here and the Aver Hayarden west. Get the words there, but Yama for the west, and the word I think it's Halab. I don't think it's quite that. It's the hither Jordan and the west Jordan. Both are called Aver Hayarden. And in the book of Joshua, you have in one chapter Aver Hayarden referring to the cities of Moab on one side, and to the cities yet to be conquered in Transjordan on the other side. So Aver Hayarden just doesn't mean on the other side of the Jordan from the author's point of view. It could be like Transjordan. You know, Transjordan is where King Hussein is and all. Amman, Transjordan. But it's Transjordan wherever you are. It could be like that. But the fact is it's used for both the east and the west. And qualified. And so, to argue from this phrase with its multiple usage to that these verses are not by Moses. Critics do it all the time, but I don't like to see it in the study Bible. And it opens the door to the other places where Moses is said to have written Aver Hayarden, you see. That's one thing. And then in the introduction to the Psalms, they say the Psalms are not prophetic, never were called prophets, classed as prophetic by the Jews, which is false, because the New Testament, the Dead Sea Scrolls, refer to the whole Old Testament as Law and the Prophet. It certainly includes the Psalms. So I'm opposed to that too. But whatever you read it with caution and with your eyes open and your defenses up, except for this work on Leviticus here. Yes.
I went to look in Wenham.
Yes.
For the subject.
Yeah.
I was looking for cleanliness and uncleanliness.
Yeah.
And kind of a project.
Yeah.
But he actually has it under holiness.
Yeah.
And Thoreau is more of a theological.
Yeah. He argues that wholeness is holiness.
Holiness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I began to think about with his discussion is the connection it makes between God being in the camp,
mm-hmm,
and those that are unclean.
Yeah.
I get to that they, because God was in the camp,
yeah,
needed to be sanctified in a sense,
yeah,
through offerings or whatever. So there was a theological connection,
yeah,
to it. And how do you respond to that?
Yeah. Well, I just don't see that wholeness, that have pigs in the camp would keep God out any more than sheep in the camp would keep God out. I don't see why God would be in the camp for a person who was sick, would not be in the camp for a person who was sick, and would be in the camp for a person who was well. In fact, I would hope it would be the other way around. He has made the assumption that wholeness is required for holiness. But you see, the laws don't make that distinction between the wholeness and the unwholeness. Now, I agree I agree that there is a religious sanction for all of this. The religious sanction is that God would supervise the health of his people. It was God who promised that he would not keep them from the diseases of Egypt. Now, it is God's blessing that being in the camp, he will take care of the Israelites. But that this idea, the jump is made from wholeness to holiness. And yet you cannot say that fish with scales are more whole. Some of these things. The priest was a public health officer. And the priest, a public health officer, he had the sanctions of sacrifice and cleanliness to keep the camp clean as God intended. But why did God intend it to be clean? He intended it to be clean for the good of the Israelites. And he would walk in the midst. One example, not in the laws of cleanliness here, it's in the book of Deuteronomy. I forget the place you can find it. It's a question of excrement. It says that a soldier, when he goes to battle, he would go outside the camp to relieve himself and cover his excrement. Because it says God is in the camp. Well, what it is teaching a soldier to use a latrine, which is certainly part of modern training. And to set up the latrine is important for the sake of the good of the people. And this is explained as God is in the camp. So God is in the camp in order to keep his people healthy. And he has made this provision, a beautiful hygienic provision. And I don't know there'd be any such provision in ancient times outside of this. And so I feel that it is indeed true that God is concerned with these, and God is in the camp, and God wants the camp to be what he knows is best for his people, and therefore holy. Now, it doesn't mean that the man who is a leper and stands out of the camp goes to hell. He is cut off from the body politic. But it doesn't mean that a person who is like this unclean is... sacrifices, of course, are prescribed for him in order to come back. There is a religious sanction for these things. It is in the hands of the priest that pleases God for these things to be done. The question is why? And I believe that the hygienic reason is, and it can be a good answer for that.
Maybe you'll mention this, but do you need camp?
Yeah, I do. I don't obey these laws. Now, understand, if you're a Jew, you have no reason not to obey these laws. Now, you ask, why should I not obey these laws? Let me say that the Jews also should not obey these laws. The Jews, in ancient times, were living in a religious state, were they not? It was a theocracy. Now, this is a little bit outside our subject, but it's a pretty important one, and it bears on the subject. The Jews were living in a theocracy, a church state, and God had promised to bless that church state. And you know, in times, at least in times of revival, you would expect probably 95% of the people of Israel to be Christians. You that believers, godly people. Christian. Now, you don't expect that of England. You don't expect that of America or Korea or someplace. God has not promised to make America 95% Christian. The Supreme Court years ago called this a Christian nation. Now I would turn around and call it a non-Christian court. You don't get a Christian nation by action of the Supreme Court. You get a Christian nation by work of the Spirit of God. And God has promised to work in the church. And in the world, you've got tares, weeds, and let both grow together. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. And so I believe that the church state of ancient Israel was unique, and we should not claim to set one up. If we had a place where we would all go out to the desert of Arizona and put in some waterworks and have a place where there would be 100% Christians, let me tell you, the next generation wouldn't be. The Lord has not promised to make any nation a most favored Christian nation today. Now, this, understand, is against the covenanter idea. It's against the Roman pretensions of the two keys. It's against the Lutheran idea of, what do they call it? Cuius regulius religio. What do they call that? Where the state determines the religion. If you're in Bavaria, you're Catholic. If you're in Hanover, you're Lutheran. If you're in Sweden, you're Lutheran. If you're in France, you're a Catholic. This was the medieval position, you know, the state church. I say this is salvation by nationality. Not by grace and not by force, but by nationality. And the Bible just doesn't say that. The Bible says that there is a nation and there is a church. Now, in the Old Testament theocracy, we say you had moral laws, civil laws, and ceremonial laws, the usual classification. I'm not sure that's the best, but it is one classification. Moral laws, civil laws, and ceremonial laws. What we usually say is that the moral laws were done away, or moral laws are perpetual. The religious laws, ceremonial laws, are done away. What about the civil laws? Well, the point is the civil laws are administered by the government. And if you're in Babylon, or if you're in Rome, you don't control the government. The government controls you. The civil laws are part of the government. So they're not done away, they're put in different hands. Now, maybe they're in good hands. Maybe they're in bad hands. I hesitate to say Republican and Democrat, but we won't get into that. But the civil laws are usually in semi-bad hands. Put it that way. They're in unsaved hands. Caesar was a brute. And many a king has been a brute. Many a well-meaning king has done some very bad things. So the civil laws are transformed and put in the hands of the state today. I give an example. It says in Deuteronomy, if you build a house, you must put a fence around the roof. King James says you must put a battlement around the roof. A battlement's a bad choice. It's a fence, I think King James and the NIV say we put a fence around the roof. Well, of course you put a fence around the roof. Why? Well, it doesn't fall off. The old National Bible Institute had an 11-story building in New York, and nobody was allowed to go up on the roof because there was no fence around it. And the city ordinance said, if you have a building so high, you must put a fence around the roof. I don't think they got it from Deuteronomy, they got it from common sense. We don't have a fence around our roofs, we don't have flat roofs, we don't go up there. We put a fence around the swimming pool so nobody will fall in. That's the same principle. And it's in the hands of the state. See? So the civil laws are in the hands of the state. We hope they may be based on such things as the Bible. The Bible in these matters speaks from common sense. And we hope that the government might speak also from common sense. Now, of course, when God gave them, it was God's common sense, which was the best for the nation. Remember, however, that the Old Testament civil laws are not perfect. God gave laws that were not perfect. Is that sensible? Do you agree with that? Do you have problems with that? God gave laws that were not perfect. Because the people were not perfect. he had laws against murder. The people needed laws against murder. But then how do you distinguish between murder and manslaughter? Well, if the man intended it, it's manslaughter. If the man didn't intend it, it's murder. But who's to tell? The judge must tell. Excuse me, I got the wrong one around. But the judge must tell. And the judge was fallible. And probably many a man in the Old Testament time was stoned to death who shouldn't have been. Jesus said that God allowed divorce in the Old Testament times. Why? For the hardness of your heart. God did not give ancient Israel a perfect civil law because the people were not perfect. In fact, if the people were perfect, you wouldn't have to have any civil law. So when we think of modern governments, they're not perfect either. But they depend on common sense and common consciousness. And some of them are better than others. Now, when I say this, you follow me? You have questions on this? You realize that this is part of the modern problem that is arising, especially in some of our Presbyterian circles, on theonomy. Theonomy says that the justice, freedom, and property must be, the way I've heard Bonson himself say it recently, that no government has a right to take away a man's life, freedom, and property except by particular laws of God. You tell that to the Imam or Shah in Persia. He doesn't have anything to do with the laws of the Bible. The government does not recognize God. And so the situation, the civil laws of today are similar to civil laws in ancient Israel inasmuch as they are decent. But they're not the same. And so I am not, as a Christian, bound by all of the civil laws of the Old Testament. I'm bound by the civil laws of my God, of my state, and by the moral laws of the Old Testament. Well, suppose you have a question of public health. Now we come back to the thing before us. Yeah. See, I think that they are laws of public health.
Public health belongs to civil health.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. I'll say something about that, but first let's take something like scarlet fever. Now here is scarlet fever. You know the Old Testament says leprosy. The King James says leprosy. The NIV says skin disease. Leprosy doesn't fit the symptoms. I mean technical leprosy, Hansen's disease. It's slower and all that. But the Old Testament laws cover such things as scarlet fever, smallpox, where you've got a rash, and it comes, you know, and it lasts for maybe six days, eight, 10 days, and this rash is a symptom. And you go to see the priest. The priest sees this rash, and he says, you're unclean. Well, this is a law of quarantine. You're out of the camp. Another 7 days, he looks at you again, rash is all gone, everything's all right. Scarlet fever, some of these things, measles, after 14 days, you're either well or you're dead. And so you're quarantined. Now, you see, quarantine means that you don't have contact with other people. Now, suppose you had a place, a city, where you had half Jews and half non-Jews. And the half Jews quarantined, and the half non-Jews did not quarantine. What would be the result of public health? You see, a quarantine is no good unless everybody does it. Isn't that right? If everybody obeys the laws of quarantine, why then they work. But if only a few people obey the laws of quarantine, they don't work very well. And so in a unified situation like ancient Israel, the laws of quarantine, everybody would use them, and they would work. Today, when I was a kid, we had the laws of quarantine, but they were for everybody. They weren't just for Presbyterians only. If it was for Presbyterians only, it wouldn't be any point to them. The laws of quarantine are only good if everybody uses them. And so I say, if it's public health, it's in the hands of the state. Now, the state in ancient times was unified, and a religious sanction was appropriate. But now it's no use to have public, it's no use to have laws like that for the Jews and Christians. For Christians to quarantine and nobody else, it really wouldn't help much. So I say that the laws of quarantine and public health like this are suitable in a unified society like ancient Israel, but they are being public. They are done away when you had separation of church and state. You see the point?
Because the other aspect, for example, the defilement always related to, you know, rituals, right?
No, I don't think I'd say it that way.
It must be awkward, yeah. In the case of defilement.
Yes, well, I think I'd say it a different way. I think I would say that defilement is of two kinds. There's a defilement of sin, and then there is the uncleanness of disease. And I would say that there are two things. Now, the uncleanness of sin, the defilement of sin, that's moral. That's real. And you must repent. The uncleanness, because you ate the wrong thing, there's nothing against the moral law there. It may defile in the sense of making you unclean physically. And as I say, there was a religious sanction for this. The priest would be the one to tell you what to do, but it isn't in the same classification. I say there's two kinds of defilement there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I just don't have time to answer the deepest question. Give us your question now.
Yeah, okay. It says temporary uncleanness may result from contact with corpse, childbirth, disease, discharges. Yeah. Then he, in parentheses, chapters 11 to 15.
Yeah.
And then he says, and various sins, including illicit sexual intercourse, chapter 18, and murder, numbers 35 to 33. All these different types of uncleanliness are regarded in some way abnormal.
Yeah.
So he groups the two, the moral and the
ceremonial, the hygienic.
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
I think that's,
and that's what you're doing. Now, I say that they are. I say that they're together in that there is a religious sanction and there are certain sacrifices that are involved. That's true. Yes, for both. Now, by the way, some of the uncleannesses here, it is not a matter of sacrifice at all. Just wash your hands and wash yourself and be unclean till the evening. And there's no sacrifice whatsoever, you see. So there is a difference between that kind of a defilement and the other kind. And I would just differ with Wenham in putting them together like that. He has a point, but to put Leviticus, this part, 11 to 6 to 15, right in line with those moral laws, which are really some of them right out of the Ten Commandments, in chapter 18 to 20, I think is an error. Well, let's think about some more next time, because these are interesting and important questions. Okay. Yeah, 10 minutes.